It is Wednesday, July 22nd. We have a lot of ground to cover today, starting with a strange diplomatic trip to Russia and a growing mess in the food supply chain. Following up on yesterday's look at global instability, we are also tracking how the government is trying to box in Chinese AI models. Let's get into it. FBI Director Kash Patel is in Russia. This trip breaks with standard diplomatic and intelligence protocols, as no FBI director has visited the country since 2013. The administration and the intelligence community have not clarified the purpose of the visit. It remains unclear if this is a strategic move or a sign that the FBI is bypassing traditional channels managed by the State Department and the CIA. The security risks here are significant. Patel is a high-value intelligence official visiting a nation known for advanced surveillance and technical hacking. There is a clear risk that his devices could be compromised or that he could be targeted for psychological operations. Beyond that, the Kremlin gains a propaganda victory by hosting a senior American official. It allows them to project an image of normalcy and soften the appearance of their geopolitical isolation. Meanwhile, the Russia sanctions bill is hitting new friction. Lawmakers had moved away from a rigid 500% tariff model toward a more flexible framework that gives the president authority over tariffs for Russian energy buyers. However, President Trump is now demanding that Iran sanctions be added to the bill. This shows how quickly consensus in the Senate can be stalled by the executive branch. This is happening against a backdrop of declining trust in American institutions. Conspiracy theories claiming Senator Lindsey Graham has been poisoned are spreading rapidly. This reflects a fragmented, low-trust environment that looks increasingly like the political climate we often associate with the regimes we oppose. When official communication is opaque, it creates a vacuum that gets filled by suspicion. In the global economy, central banks are no longer moving in sync. The Federal Reserve is staying patient, the European Central Bank is leaning toward more tightening, and the Bank of Japan is normalizing policy at a slow pace. Each is trying to balance economic growth against the threat of inflation. The U.S. outlook assumes inflation will keep cooling as energy prices and shelter costs level off. If that happens, the Fed will hold steady. But there is a real risk that policymakers are underestimating broad demand. If geopolitical shocks hit energy markets or core goods prices stay high, the Fed could be forced into late-year rate hikes. That could trigger a sharper contraction than anyone is currently planning for. Europe is in a different position. The European Central Bank has more room to hike because its rates are near neutral. The risk there is fiscal fragmentation. As rates rise, the debt burden for member states like France, Italy, and Spain grows, which increases political risk during upcoming elections. It is a feedback loop where monetary policy ends up worsening the very fiscal instability it is meant to manage. Asia is operating under its own set of rules. Japan is normalizing slowly, driven by external inflation rather than domestic consumption. In China, the response to a soft second-quarter GDP report of around 5% will likely be fiscal. The government is expected to use budget room for infrastructure spending to boost growth in the second half of the year. The main takeaway is that global central bank policy has decoupled. The primary risk is a policy error caused by misjudging the source of inflation. Whether it is temporary supply issues or entrenched demand, getting it wrong could force an overreaction that triggers unnecessary volatility in debt and currency markets. In domestic politics, we are seeing the business of outrage change the way public discourse works. We saw this recently with the focus on ICE enforcement in Minneapolis. Influencers bypassed traditional verification to push sensationalist clips that manipulated public perception and deepened tribal divides. This leads to a decline in genuine debate. Public figures frequently switch lanes or adopt aggressive personas to reach profitable audience segments. This moves them away from journalism and into the realm of propaganda that reinforces the confirmation bias of their base. Political debate has effectively become a sport where the goal is signaling victory to one's own audience. This creates a closed loop. Even if a person performs poorly in a substantive debate, their base perceives them as the winner. This insulation prevents the exchange of ideas and ensures that the priority remains protecting the team identity rather than pursuing the truth. Speaking of institutional structures, the Democratic Socialists of America have proposed abolishing the Senate, the presidency, and the Supreme Court. They want a unicameral legislature. This proposal is a direct challenge to the American constitutional design, which uses the separation of powers to force deliberation and limit federal authority. This debate is driving an internal struggle within the Democratic Party. While the proposal is currently limited to highly liberal enclaves, it creates a strategic risk for the party. By failing to distance themselves from these radical critiques, Democrats risk alienating moderate and independent voters who generally prefer stability over systemic rupture. At the same time, the broader political discourse is stuck in a stalemate. The persistent, polarizing presence of Donald Trump creates a self-correcting mechanic where both his base and his critics mobilize to negate each other's gains. This keeps the country at a baseline 50-50 division, where systemic shocks generate intense noise but rarely move the needle. Representative Jim Hymns warns that the U.S. faces two major threats: the degradation of democratic norms through election denialism, and the erosion of intelligence capabilities due to partisan gridlock. Hymns notes that Donald Trump has established a pattern of rejecting election results that do not favor him, which creates a high probability that he will contest future outcomes. The risk is a shift from rhetoric to action. If supporters are mobilized to monitor polling places or use claims of foreign interference to seize voting equipment, the chain of custody could break. This would effectively nullify election results regardless of the actual vote count. Because the Republican Party is not providing internal checks, the burden of defense falls entirely on civil society and local election administrators. On the intelligence front, the lapse of Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, creates a dangerous environment. While intelligence collection continues under existing authorizations, the lack of a statutory foundation creates an asymmetric vulnerability. If private companies decide to withdraw cooperation, the U.S. would lose its primary mechanism for tracking foreign espionage. Congress is unlikely to act until a major failure occurs, leaving the nation in a precarious, reactive state. The Department of Defense is also facing criticism for a lack of transparency regarding the conflict in Iran. The Pentagon has not held a press briefing since May, and it has been slow to release casualty data. Secretary Pete Hegseth has not provided Congress with a clear exit strategy despite requesting $67 billion in funding. This information void makes it impossible for lawmakers to assess the effectiveness of the war or learn tactical lessons, such as how to defend against Iranian drone capabilities. The conflict has also led to mission creep. Objectives have shifted from regime change to nuclear nonproliferation, and now to securing traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. This lack of consensus is putting a strain on the military, with Navy deployments like the USS Lincoln exceeding 200 consecutive days at sea. In South Carolina, a fractured Republican primary is forcing candidates to adopt increasingly far-right positions. This gives Democratic candidate Dr. Annie Andrews a strategic opening. She is running as a non-politician with a professional background in pediatrics, attempting to decouple her campaign from national party branding. Andrews is focusing on the downstream impacts of federal policy, specifically potential Medicaid budget cuts that threaten rural health care. She is betting that voters are exhausted by career politicians and the transactional nature of current governance. This includes the recent imposition of 50% tariffs on Canadian goods and the selective use of executive clemency. Finally, a food safety outbreak linked to Taylor Farms highlights the danger of communication failures in federal agencies. The FDA announced a false positive lab result early in the investigation, which gave the company room to challenge the findings and confuse the public. Former officials point to an understaffed department caused by federal budget cuts. This creates a cycle where lower funding limits the ability to conduct fast, accurate investigations. Agencies then issue less vetted alerts to make up for the data gap, which in turn erodes public trust when those alerts are retracted. Because Taylor Farms is a major supplier, this is a systemic shock. When federal communication fails, the volume of affected products amplifies the damage. Speaking of things that are falling apart, the tech world is currently obsessed with how to build AI that actually works under pressure. The U.S. government is ramping up pressure on the use of Chinese open-weight artificial intelligence models within American borders. The debate centers on whether to use advisory bulletins and soft law to effectively ban these models, which some argue represent a form of state-sponsored dumping. OpenAI strategist Dean Ball contends that because these models have reached parity with Western frontier systems, relying on them will collapse the business model for domestic labs and dry up necessary long-term infrastructure investment. But there is a catch. Implementing policy through what amounts to manufactured uncertainty creates a dangerous precedent. It allows agencies to bypass evidence-based regulation in favor of a system that can be weaponized against any future competitor. Analyst Ryan Fedisek, pronounced FEH to check, points out that the U.S. focus remains locked on model benchmarks, which misses the point. China is currently hitting physical bottlenecks in compute, power grids, and high-bandwidth memory. By focusing on banning the software, the U.S. risks ignoring the actual physical race for industrial capacity. Look, this is starting to look like a protectionist trap. If the U.S. successfully forces companies away from competitive, lower-cost Chinese models, it effectively shields domestic providers from the existential pressure to innovate or lower their own costs. This is essentially techno-feudalism. It forces the market to pay digital rents to a few incumbents rather than allowing technology to commoditize and spread. It is a hell of a thing to watch a government pretend this is all about security when it is clearly about protecting revenue streams. The geopolitical reality is shifting fast. Models like Moonshot AI's Kimi K3 and Alibaba's Qwen 3.8 have narrowed the capability gap with U.S. frontier models to just 1 or 2 months. This progress is largely driven by distillation, where developers train smaller, efficient models on the output of massive state-of-the-art systems. Because these are provided as open-weight models, they are seeing rapid global adoption. The strategy for businesses is shifting toward model-agnostic architectures. The idea here is simple. Never tether your entire operation to one provider. Organizations are moving toward orchestration layers that assign tasks to models based on real-time costs, regulatory compliance, and security needs. If you are a business leader and you haven't taken an inventory of your AI dependencies, you are essentially sitting on a geopolitical ticking time bomb. Meanwhile, the hardware side of the house is getting more expensive. NVIDIA is shipping its Vera Rubin platform, utilizing new robotic assembly processes to speed up data center deployment. However, the supply chain is feeling the squeeze. TSMC has finalized plans to raise manufacturing prices by as much as 10% by 2027. They are betting that the AI boom is enough to pass those costs onto everyone else. We are also seeing the end of the speculative hype phase. Investors are no longer interested in vague growth stories. They want to see concrete capital deployment. Tesla, for instance, is under the microscope. If they do not execute on their $25 billion capital expenditure plan for 2026, the valuation risk is significant. There is also a massive legal cloud hanging over the sector. Ongoing copyright litigation against Anthropic has set a precedent that will almost certainly invite a wave of new litigation against other developers. Between that and the antitrust scrutiny blocking mergers like Paramount and Warner Brothers Discovery, the environment is getting hostile. Finally, the technical focus is moving away from just building a bigger brain. There are reports that Microsoft is looking at integrating large-scale Chinese models to avoid the massive API costs of OpenAI and Anthropic. Google is taking a different path, attempting to freeze parts of its Gemini architecture directly into custom silicon. They are targeting a 6 to 10 times increase in tokens per watt efficiency. The industry is moving toward graph-based orchestration, where agents navigate nodes and choose paths dynamically, rather than just following rigid loops. It is a shift toward specialized, efficient systems. The race is no longer about who has the most parameters. It is about who can build the most efficient, interoperable, and stable architecture that does not fall apart when the next government mandate hits. If you are still betting on raw scale, you are probably already losing. That race for efficiency is a hell of a contrast to the current state of horse racing, where the field is looking pretty thin. Baby Vina won the Haskell Stakes. Following that finish, analysts at In the Money Media are calling the current three-year-old racing division unstable. They argue the victory says more about a weak field and helpful track conditions than it does about the emergence of a legitimate long-term champion. Here is the thing about mid-season results. They are prone to being misleading. The industry is currently packed with what people call summer horses, contenders peaking right now who lack the long-term, triple-crown-level dominance we usually look for. The advice from the analysts is simple. Stop betting on reputations built back in the spring. Look at recent form and progressive speed figures instead. Take Baby Vino's 100 Bayer speed figure. It is being viewed with extreme caution. If that number was inflated by the track, betting on the horse for a mile and a quarter race like the Traverse is a high-risk, low-reward gamble. If the field was weak and the dirt was fast, that score is an outlier. It is not a reliable baseline for what that horse will do next. Then there is the human element. The Haskell highlighted how jockey temperament creates artificial volatility in these high-stakes races. When riders decide to focus on suppressing a specific rival instead of just running their own race, they break the math. It turns out the jockey's mood is a measurable risk factor that can completely invalidate your traditional performance metrics. There is also a clear divide between elite speed and what they call the scramble threshold. If a horse has a 122 Bayer figure, like Knightsbridge, that speed acts as a defensive asset. They do not need to prove they can win a messy, adverse race because they are simply too fast for the rest of the pack. If a horse does not have that massive margin of error, the only thing that matters is their ability to navigate a scramble. Finally, consider the Diana Stakes. Chad Brown won it for the 11th time. At this point, it is becoming clear that high-level turf racing is less about the horse and more about the trainer. It is about a systemic understanding of distance and track configuration. People are starting to joke that the race should just be named after Brown. It is a hell of a thing to say, but when trainer expertise becomes a more reliable indicator than pedigree, we are looking at a fundamental shift in how the sport operates. The season is in a transition phase. If you are looking for value, the play is to find the unexposed horses taking a developmental step forward. Chasing the declining returns of horses that peaked months ago is a losing game. That is where we are. The instability in racing isn't unique, as the sports business world is also scrambling to fix its broken distribution models. The NHL is moving its media production in-house. The league is investing eight figures into a new production hub to manage game and studio content, effectively replacing the role previously held by regional sports networks. This shift is a direct response to the insolvency of third-party distributors, most notably Diamond Sports Group. By taking this on, the NHL is trading the relative safety of legacy media contracts for the operational headache of running its own shop. It is a bet that direct control provides a more stable foundation than relying on middle management networks that are currently falling apart. In college sports, the SEC, the Southeastern Conference, is getting serious about leaving the NCAA. Commissioner Greg Sankey has acknowledged that the conference is actively discussing a potential breakaway. This is not just posturing. It is a direct result of the current mess surrounding NIL, eligibility, and the lack of clear federal legislation. If the SEC actually pulls the trigger, it would essentially shatter the existing power structure of college athletics. The conference is clearly preparing for a future where it has to govern itself to protect its economic and competitive dominance. Meanwhile, the University of Michigan is looking for a new athletic director. Ward Manuel, who had been under contract until 2030, is out. An independent review cited significant failures in accountability and the enforcement of conduct standards within the department. Michigan remains a massive brand, but this vacancy kicks off what will likely be a very aggressive scramble to find a leader who can navigate the demands of big money alumni while keeping the NCAA compliance office off their back. Finally, the NFL and Tomorrow's Sports have appointed Brendan Donahue as the first president of their new flag football league. Donahue comes from a background in esports and NBA team operations. That hire tells you exactly what the league is prioritizing. They aren't looking for someone to just keep the lights on. They are looking for someone with a proven track record of building new properties from scratch. Look, there is a clear pattern here. Whether it is the NHL building its own media hub, the SEC hovering over the exit door of the NCAA, or Michigan Cleaning House, organizations are done with decentralized legacy models. They are terrified of market volatility and administrative failure. They are choosing to pull the levers of control inside their own walls, even if it makes their balance sheets more complicated. It is a shift from playing the game under someone else's rules to owning the stadium, the broadcast, and the governance. It is safer, sure, but it is also a hell of a lot more work. We are seeing a hard pivot away from the old guard. If you are not in charge of your own infrastructure, you are just waiting for someone else to fail on your behalf. It seems like everyone is trying to build their own silo these days, which is exactly what a few savvy independent publishers are doing too. Court Watch, the independent newsletter run by terrorism scholar Seamus Hughes, pronounced Seamus Hyougus, is pulling in nearly $100,000 a year. That sounds like a solid haul for a one-man operation. Here is the catch. It is his third job. Hughes spends his time digging through the federal court system, specifically the PACER database, to find documents that traditional media outlets miss. He then feeds those findings to major publications like Rolling Stone and 404 Media. It is essentially a high-skill, low-visibility supply chain. The bigger outlets get the scoop, and Hughes gets the credibility. The problem is that credibility does not always pay the bills. Third-party aggregators often scrape his labor without giving him a dime or a mention. Because his model relies on direct subscribers, that lack of attribution is a direct hit to his growth. He is currently stuck in a weird loop where he has to spend his limited time on algorithmic grinding and self-promotion just to keep the lights on. It is a hell of a way to run a public service. The project is now shifting toward a media collective structure to gain legal protection for its reporting. It is a necessary move if he wants to keep going after litigious actors without getting crushed by legal fees. But the fundamental tension remains. You have a guy doing vital investigative work who has to choose between doing the actual reporting or spending his day fighting for discoverability in an internet ecosystem that has effectively killed organic reach for anything that isn't loud or partisan. Meanwhile, the newsletter platform BeHeave is trying to solve a different set of problems for creators. They are positioning themselves as the Shopify of the newsletter world. Their entire pitch is that they are an infrastructure provider, not a destination platform. They want to be the invisible plumbing underneath your brand, rather than an aggregator like Substack that tries to capture reader attention for itself. The business model here is straightforward. They charge for a toolset instead of taking a cut of your revenue. That is a massive draw for professional media companies that want to avoid being shackled to a centralized network. If you are a creator who has already built an audience, you don't want your platform to become a bottleneck or a competitor. You just want the software to work. Behive is also using artificial intelligence to handle the mundane parts of the business. They are automating customer support and routine maintenance to avoid the kind of bloated hiring cycles that usually kill software companies. It is a classic move for operational leverage. By keeping their own headcount low, they can offer enterprise-grade features to individual creators at a price point that makes sense. It is a bet on a specific vision of the future. The idea is that the newsletter market is not a zero-sum game of viral content. It is a fragmented map of niches. If you can provide the infrastructure that makes it easy for a creator to own their audience and their data, you become an indispensable utility. It is not flashy, but it is durable. Finally, we have to look at what is happening over at ESPN. The network recently cut a significant number of staff members in a single, eventized round of layoffs. They didn't let contracts expire on their own timeline. They chose to rip the bandage off all at once. The official word is that this is about restructuring following their acquisition of the NFL Network. They are trying to clear out redundant roles before their first Super Bowl broadcast. It is a classic move to prioritize administrative efficiency over the headache of a drawn-out PR disaster. But the shift goes deeper than just headcount. ESPN is moving away from the traditional, centralized host model. They are now prioritizing what you might call a stretch-four approach. They want talent who can serve as opinionated, multi-platform experts. Look at Pat McAfee. He brings his own audience, his own production team, and his own brand. The network is essentially outsourcing its creative labor to people who don't actually need the network to survive. This changes the entire power dynamic. Talent is no longer looking at ESPN as a place for a long-term, stable career. They are looking at it as a distribution platform to grow their own independent ventures. The network is becoming a landlord for influencers rather than a home for institutional journalists. The inevitable result is that institutional loyalty is cratering. When you make layoffs a high-profile, singular event, you turn every departure into a symbol of corporate decline. The employees left behind aren't focusing on the network's identity. They are focusing on their own podcasts and social feeds, just in case they are next on the chopping block. ESPN is effectively trading its long-term stability for the reach of external influencers. It might show up well on a short-term balance sheet, but they are hollowing out their own brand in the process. When you stop developing your own talent and start renting it from whoever is currently loud on the internet, you cease to be the primary authority. You just become a venue. It is a shitty situation for the people involved, but it is also a pretty clear signal of where the industry is heading. When the cost of maintaining a central institution becomes too high, the institution stops being an institution and starts looking for an exit strategy. The question is what happens to the sports media landscape once the center finally stops holding. While some people are building empires, others are just trying to figure out how to be happy without a finish line in sight. A recent episode of a psychology podcast dug into the craft of happiness. They argued that happiness is not a destination, but a daily craft of incremental improvement. Viewing happiness as a skill, like playing an instrument, prevents the anxiety of waiting for a finish line that doesn't exist. When you treat setbacks as data points rather than failures, you stop measuring your self-worth against a perfect outcome. It is a shift from being finished to being in progress. Therapy is also moving toward behavioral change rather than just insight. The focus is shifting from simply understanding your past to actively managing your reactions today. This involves identifying what is called idiot compassion, where friends validate your dysfunctional behaviors to keep the peace. Real growth often requires professional intervention to spot the blind spots you cannot see yourself. Boundaries are also being reframed as tools for connection, not just isolation. By setting a limit, you force the dynamics of a relationship to evolve. If you refuse to hold that line, you stay trapped in the same old cycle. Additionally, you are an unreliable narrator of your own life. You likely hold on to first draft stories about your identity. Editing those scripts and finally grieving the childhood you didn't get is the only way to stop using your current partners to settle old scores. Finally, David Bayer suggests that focusing on the gap between where you are and where you want to be creates emotional resistance. If you spend your time analyzing why you haven't achieved a result yet, you are only anchoring your energy in the state of not having. The goal is to pursue your work with intensity while remaining detached from your current lack of results. It is a hell of a tightrope to walk. You want the outcome, but you have to stop obsessing over its absence to actually get there. If you can manage your own internal state, maybe you can manage your fantasy sports team, too, provided the interface doesn't drive you crazy. Fantasy Premier League is overhauling its interface for the 2026-27 season, and the goal is total transparency. The league is moving away from an experience that once relied on third-party data sites and toward a fully centralized, real-time platform. Here is what is changing. The official app will now feature built-in price change predictors, live rank tracking, and real-time bonus point updates. The lockout time for transfers has also been pushed back to 9 in the morning on the day after the final match of the week. Look, here's the thing. For years, the edge in FPL came from knowing things other people didn't. Elite managers used external models to track price volatility or predict fixture difficulty shifts. By baking these tools directly into the game, the organizers are effectively nuking that information asymmetry. It's going to level the playing field, sure, but it's also going to turn the game into a much higher frequency environment. With everyone seeing the same price movement predictions every 15 minutes, you can expect the market to become significantly more volatile. We're likely looking at a season where herd behavior drives prices up and down faster than ever before. If you're the type of manager who likes to sit back and wait for injury news, you might find yourself priced out of moves before the weekend even starts. The scoring system is also getting a tweak to address the center back problem that dominated last year. The game is raising the threshold for defensive actions like clearances and blocks, while removing the penalty for being tackled. It's an attempt to make fullbacks and creative playmakers more viable, and the new goalkeeper model, which adds points for saving big chances, is an interesting play to raise the floor for keepers. But don't expect a wholesale revolution. Early analysis suggests these scoring shifts are incremental. Unless the defensive scoring model changes drastically, center backs will probably remain the meta play. Anyway, the advice coming out of this is pretty clear. Stop treating the first 5 weeks as a sprint for rank. Because so many teams are currently undergoing managerial transitions, the industry consensus is that you should treat the opening phase of the season as an information-gathering period. Maintain structural flexibility. If you lock your entire budget into 3 premium strikers, you're trapped. Keep your squad liquid enough that any player is reachable within 2 moves. The days of winning because you had a proprietary spreadsheet are effectively over. Now, success is going to depend on your ability to navigate the volatility without losing your head during a live match. It's a different kind of game now. It's less about who can calculate the market best and more about who can resist the urge to panic when the live data starts flashing red. Which, honestly, sounds like a hell of a challenge for the people who have spent the last decade playing FPL like it's a day trading terminal. A few other things worth knowing this morning. First, the so-called sex recession among Gen Z researchers are pointing to smartphones as the culprit, arguing that digital life offers a frictionless, low-risk way to feel connected. It turns out that when you can simulate intimacy on a screen, the messy, high-stakes risk of real-world rejection just feels like a bad deal. John Stewart is making a simple argument about governing that our politicians seem incapable of grasping. He says public trust isn't built on slogans or ideological purity tests, but on whether the potholes get filled and the services actually work. It's a novel concept, I know, but apparently people prefer results over rhetoric. Texas is doubling down on its strategy to lure big business away from the coasts. The state just handed Goldman Sachs an $18 million grant, using light regulation and tax incentives as a bribe. They want to turn Texas into a financial hub, which is a hell of a thing to do while claiming to be the land of rugged, independent capitalism. Finally, there is a shift happening in quantum computing. Companies like PsiQuantum are ditching the custom, hand-built lab experiments in favor of standard semiconductor manufacturing. They are betting that if you can use the same factories that make your phone chips, you can actually scale the technology into something useful. It turns out, even in the world of high-end physics, assembly lines still beat bespoke prototypes. That is the news for today. If you have thoughts on where we are headed, feel free to keep them to yourself until tomorrow. See you then.